Where's Pam?
We gave her some medication, Sam answered. She ought to be sleeping now.
She is, Sarah confirmed, passing through the room on the way to the kitchen. I just checked.
Poor thing, she's exhausted. She's been doing without sleep for some time. It's catching up with her.
But if she's been taking sleeping pills...
John, your body reacts strangely to the things, Sam explained. It fights them off, or tries to. At the same time, it becomes dependent on them. Sleep will be her big problem for a while.
There's something else, Sarah reported. She's very frightened of something, but she wouldn't say what it was.
She paused, then decided that Kelly ought to know.
She's been abused, John. I didn't ask about it, one thing at a time, but somebody's given her a rough time.
Oh?
Kelly looked up from the sofa.
What do you mean?
I mean she's been sexually assaulted, Sarah said in a calm, professional voice that belied her personal feelings.
You mean raped? Kelly asked in a low voice while the muscles of his arms tensed.
Sarah nodded, unable now to hide her distaste.
Almost certainly. Probably more than once. There is also evidence of physical abuse on her back and buttocks.
I didn't notice.
You're not a doctor, Sarah pointed out.
How did you meet?
Kelly told her, remembering the look in Pam's eyes and knowing now what it must have been from.
Why hadn't he noticed it?
Why hadn't he noticed a lot of things, Kelly raged.
So she was trying to escape. I wonder if the same man got her on the barbiturates, Sarah asked.
Nice guy, whoever it was.
You mean that somebody's been working her over and got her on drugs, Kelly said. But why?
Kelly, please don't take this wrong. But she might have been a prostitute. Pimps control girls that way.
Sarah Rosen hated herself for saying that, but this was business and Kelly had to know.
She's young, pretty, a runaway from a dysfunctional family. The physical abuse, the undernourishment, it all fits the pattern.
Kelly was looking down at the floor.
But she's not like that.
I don't understand.
But in some ways he did, he told himself, thinking back. The ways in which she'd clung to him and drawn him to her. How much was simply skill, and how much real human feelings? It was a question he had no desire to face.
What was the right thing to do? Follow your mind? Follow your heart?
And where might they lead?
She's fighting back, John. She's got guts.
Sarah sat across from Kelly.
She's been on the road for over 4 years, doing God knows what, but something in her won't quit.
But she can't do it alone. She needs you.
Now I have a question.
Sarah looked hard at him.
Will you be there to help her?
Kelly looked up, his blue eyes the color of ice as he searched for what he really felt.
You guys are really worked up about this, aren't you?
Sarah sipped from a drink she'd made for herself. She was rather a dumpy woman, short and overweight. Her black hair hadn't seen a stylist in months.
All in all, she looked like the sort of woman who, behind the wheel of a car, attracts the hatred of male drivers. But she spoke with focused passion, and her intelligence was already very clear to her host.
Do you have any idea how bad it's getting? 10 years ago, drug abuse was so rare that I hardly had to bother with it.
Oh, sure, I knew about it. Read the articles from Lexington, and every so often we'd get a heroin case.
Not very many.
Just a black problem, people thought.
Nobody really gave much of a damn.
We're paying for that mistake now. In case you didn't notice, that's all changed, and it happened practically overnight. Except for the project I'm working on, I'm nearly full-time on kids with drug problems. I wasn't trained for this. I'm a scientist, an expert on adverse interactions, chemical structures, how we can design new drugs to do special things. But now I have to spend nearly all of my time in clinical work, trying to keep children alive who should be just learning how to drink a beer, but instead have their systems full of chemical shit that should never have made it outside a goddamned laboratory.
And it's going to get worse, Sam noted gloomily.
Sarah nodded.
Oh, yeah, the next big one is cocaine.
She needs you, John, Sarah said again, leaning forward. It was as though she had surrounded herself with her own storm cloud of electrical energy. "You damn well better be there for her, boy. You be there for her. Somebody dealt her a really shitty hand, but she's fighting. There's a person in there."
"Yes, ma'am," Kelly said humbly. He looked up and smiled, no longer confused.
"In case you were worried, I decided that a while back."
"Good," Sarah nodded curtly.
"What do I do first?"
"More than anything else, she needs rest. She needs good food, and she needs time to flush the barbiturates out of her system. We'll support her with phenobarb just in case we have withdrawal problems. I don't expect that. I examined her while you two were gone. Her physical problem is not so much addiction as exhaustion and undernourishment. She ought to be 10 pounds heavier than she is. She ought to tolerate withdrawal rather well if we support her in other ways."
"Me, you mean?" Kelly asked.
"That's a lot of it." She looked over towards the open bedroom door and sighed, the tension going out of her. "Well, given her underlying condition, that phenobarb will probably have her out for the rest of the night. Tomorrow we start feeding her and exercising her."
"For now," Sarah announced, "we can feed ourselves."
Dinner talk focused deliberately on other subjects, and Kelly found himself delivering a lengthy discourse on the bottom contours of the Chesapeake Bay, segueing into what he knew about good fishing spots. It was soon decided that his visitors would stay until Monday evening. Time over the dinner table lengthened, and it was nearly 10 before they rose. Kelly cleaned up, then quietly entered his bedroom to hear Pam's quiet breathing. Only 13 feet long and a scant 3,065 pounds of mass, nearly half of that fuel, the Buffalo Hunter angled towards the ground as it accelerated to an initial cruising speed of over 500 knots. Already its navigational computer, made by Lear Siegler, was monitoring time and altitude in a very limited way. The drone was programmed to follow a specific flight path and altitude, all painstakingly predetermined for systems that were by later standards absurdly primitive. For all that, Cody 193 was a sporty-looking beast. Its profile was remarkably like that of a blue shark with a protruding nose and underslung air intake for a mouth. Stateside, it was often painted with aggressive rows of teeth. In this particular case, an experimental paint scheme, flat white beneath and mottled brown and green atop, was supposed to make it harder to spot from the ground and the air. It was also stealthy, a term not yet invented. Blankets of RAM, radar-absorbing material, were integral with the wing surfaces, and the air intake was screened to attenuate the radar return off the whirling engine blades. Cody 193 crossed the border between Laos and North Vietnam at 11:41:38 local time. Still descending, it leveled out for the first time at 500 feet above ground level, turning northeast, somewhat slower now in the thicker air this close to the ground. The low altitude and small size of the speeding drone made it a difficult target, but by no means an impossible one. And outlying gun positions of the dense and sophisticated North Vietnamese air defense network spotted it. The drone flew directly towards a recently sighted 37-millimeter twin gun mount, whose alert crew got their mount slewed around quickly enough to loose 20 quick rounds, 3 of which passed within feet of the diminutive shape, but missed. Cody 193 took no note of this, and neither jinked nor evaded the fire. Without a brain, without eyes, it continued along on its flight path rather like a toy train around a Christmas tree, while its new owner ate breakfast in the kitchen. In fact, it was being watched. A distant EC-121 warning star tracked 193 by means of a coded radar transponder located atop the drone's vertical fin. "Keep going, baby," a major whispered to himself, watching his scope. He knew of the mission, how important it was, and why nobody else could be allowed to know. Next to him was a small segment from a topographical map. The drone turned north at the right place, dropping down to 300 feet as it found the right valley, following a small tributary river. At least the guys who programmed it knew their stuff, the major thought.
193 had burned a third of its fuel by now and was consuming the remaining amount very rapidly at low level, flying between the crests of the unseen hills to the left and right. The programmers had done their best, but there was one chillingly close call when a puff of wind forced it to the right before the autopilot could correct, and 193 missed an unusually tall tree by a scant 70 feet. Two militiamen were on that crest and fired off their rifles at it, and again the rounds missed. One of them started down the hill towards a telephone, but his companion called for him to stop as 193 flew blindly on. By the time a call was made and received, the enemy aircraft would be long gone, and, besides, they'd done their duty in shooting at it. He worried about where their bullets had landed, but it was too late for that. Colonel Robin Zacharias, USAF, was walking across the dirt of what might in other times and circumstances be called a parade ground. But there were no parades here. A prisoner for over 6 months, he faced every day as a struggle, contemplating misery more deep and dark than anything he'd been able to imagine. Shot down on his 89th mission, within sight of rotation home, a completely successful mission brought to a bloody end by nothing more significant than bad luck. Worse, his bear was dead. And he was probably the lucky one, the colonel thought, as he was led across the compound by two small, unfriendly men with rifles. His arms were tied behind him, and his ankles were hobbled because they were afraid of him despite their guns. And even with all that, he was also being watched by men in the guard towers. "I must really look scary to the little bastards," the fighter pilot told himself. Zacharias didn't feel very dangerous. His back was still injured from the ejection. He'd hit the ground severely crippled, and his effort to evade capture had been little more than a token gesture. A whole 100 yards of movement over a period of 5 minutes, right into the arms of the gun crew which had shredded his aircraft. The abuse had begun there. Paraded through 3 separate villages, stoned and spat upon, he'd finally ended up here, wherever here was. There were seabirds. Perhaps he was close to the sea, the colonel speculated. But the memorial in Salt Lake City, several blocks from his boyhood home, reminded him that gulls were not merely creatures of the sea. In the preceding months, he had been subjected to all sorts of physical abuse, but it had strangely slackened off in the past few weeks. Perhaps they'd become tired of hurting him, Zacharias told himself. And maybe there really was a Santa Claus, too, he thought, his head looking down at the dirt. There was little consolation to be had here. There were other prisoners, but his attempts at communicating with them had all failed. His cell had no windows. He'd seen 2 faces, neither of which he had recognized. On both occasions he'd started to call out a greeting, only to be clubbed to the ground by one of his guards. Both men had seen him but made no sound. In both cases he'd seen a smile and a nod, the best that they could do. Both men were of his age, and, he supposed, about his rank, but that was all he knew. What was most frightening to a man who had much to be frightened about was that this was not what he had been briefed to expect. It wasn't the Hanoi Hilton, where all the POWs were supposed to have been congregated. Beyond that, he knew virtually nothing, and the unknown can be the most frightening thing of all, especially to a man accustomed over a period of 20 years to being absolute master of his fate. His only consolation, he thought, was that things were as bad as they could be. On that, he was wrong.
"Good morning, Colonel Zacharias," a voice called across the compound.
He looked up to see a man taller than himself, Caucasian, and wearing a uniform very different from that of his guards. He strode towards the prisoner with a smile.
"Very different from Omaha, isn't it?"
That was when he heard a noise, a thin, screeching whine approaching from the southwest. He turned on instinct. An aviator must always look to see an aircraft, no matter where he might be. It appeared in an instant before the guards had a chance to react. Buffalo hunter, Zacharias thought, standing erect, turning to watch it pass, staring at it, holding his head up,
seeing the black rectangle of the camera window, whispering a prayer that the device was operating. When the guards realized what he was doing, a gun butt in the kidneys dropped the colonel to the ground. Suppressing a curse, he tried to deal with the pain as a pair of boots came into his restricted field of vision.
"Do not get overly excited," the other man said. "It's heading to Haiphong to count the ships. Now, my friend, we need to become acquainted."
Cody 193 continued northeast, holding a nearly constant speed and altitude as it entered the dense air defense belt surrounding North Vietnam's only major port. The cameras in the Buffalo Hunter recorded several AAA batteries, observation points, and more than a few people with AK-47s, all of whom made at least a token shot at the drone. The only thing 193 had going for it was its small size. Otherwise, it flew on a straight and level course while its cameras snapped away, recording the images on 2.25-inch film. About the only thing not shot at it were surface-to-air missiles. 193 was too low for that. "Go, baby, go," the major said, 200 miles away. Outside, the four piston engines of the Warning Star were straining to maintain the altitude necessary for him to watch the drone's progress. His eyes were locked on the flat glass screen, following the blinking blip of the radar transponder. Other controllers monitored the location of other American aircraft also visiting the enemy country, in constant communication with Red Crown, the Navy ship that managed air operations from the seaward side. "Turn east, baby. Now." Right on schedule, Cody 193 banked hard to the right, coming a touch lower and screaming over the Haiphong docks at 500 knots, 100 tracer rounds in its wake. Longshoremen and sailors from various ships looked up in curiosity and irritation, and not a little fear for all the steel flying in the sky over their heads. "Yes!" the major shouted, loudly enough that the sergeant controller to his left looked up in irritation. "You were supposed to keep things quiet here." He keyed his mic to speak to Red Crown. "Cody 193 is bingo." "Roger, copy bingo on 193," the acknowledgement came back. It was a false use of the bingo code word, which ordinarily meant an aircraft with a low fuel state. But it was a term so commonly used that it made a more than adequate disguise. The Navy enlisted man on the other end of the circuit then told an orbiting helicopter crew to wake up. The drone cleared the coast right on schedule, keeping low for a few more miles before going into its final climb, down to its last 100 pounds of fuel as it reached its pre-programmed point 30 miles offshore and began circling. Now another transponder came on, one tuned to the search radars of U.S. Navy picket ships. One of these, the destroyer Henry B. Wilson, took note of the expected target at the expected time and place. Her missile technicians used the opportunity to run a practice intercept problem, but had to switch off their illumination radars after a few seconds. It made the Airedales nervous. Circling at 5,000 feet, Cody 193 finally ran out of fuel and became a glider. When the airspeed fell to the right number, explosive bolts blew a hatch cover off the top, deploying a parachute. The Navy helicopter was already on station, and the white chute made for a fine target. The drone's weight was a scant 1,500 pounds now, barely that of 8 men. Wind and visibility cooperated this day. The chute was snagged on their first attempt, and the helicopter turned at once, heading for the carrier USS Constellation, where the drone was carefully lowered into a cradle, ending its 60-second combat mission. Before the helicopter could find its own spot on the flight deck, a technician was already unfastening the cover plate on the photo compartment and yanking the heavy film cassette from its slot. He took it below at once and handed it over to another technician in the ship's elaborate photo lab. Processing required a brief 6 minutes, and the still damp film was wiped clean and handed over yet again to an intelligence officer. It was better than good. The film was run from one spool to another over a flat glass plate under which was a pair of fluorescent lights.
"Well, Lieutenant," the captain asked tensely.
"Okay, sir, wait one." Turning the spool, he pointed to the third image. "There's our first reference point. There's number two. She was right on course. Okay, here's the IP. Down the valley, over the hill. There, sir. We have three frames. Good ones. The sun was just right. Clear day. You know why they call these babies buffalo hunters? It's... Let me see." The captain nearly shoved the junior officer out of the way. There was a man there, an American, with two guards and a fourth man. But it was the American he wanted to see. "Here, sir." The lieutenant handed over a magnifying glass. "We might get a good face off of this, and we can play with the negative some more if you give us a little time. Like I said, the cameras can tell the difference between a male and a female." "Hmm." The face was black, meaning a white man on the negative. "But, damn, I can't tell." "Captain, that's our job, okay?" He was an intelligence officer. The captain was not. "Let us do our job, sir."
"He's one of ours."
"Sure as hell, sir, and this guy isn't. Let me take these back to the lab for positive prints and blow-ups. The air wing will want to look at the port shots, too." "They can wait." "No, sir, they can't," the lieutenant pointed out. But he took a pair of scissors and removed the relevant shots. The remainder of the roll was handed to a chief petty officer, while the lieutenant and the captain went back to the photo lab. Fully 2 months of work had gone into the flight of Cody 193, and the captain lusted for the information he knew to be on those 3 2-and-a-quarter-inch frames. An hour later, he had it. An hour after that, he boarded a flight to Da Nang. Another hour, and he was on a flight to Cubey Point Naval Air Station in the Philippines, followed by a puddle jumper to Clark Air Force Base, and a KC-135 that would fly directly to California. Despite the time and rigors of the next 20 hours of flying, the captain slept briefly and fitfully, having solved a mystery whose answer just might change the policy of his government. Chapter 4. First Light. Kelly slept nearly 8 hours, again arising at the sound of the gulls to find that Pam wasn't there. He went outside and saw her standing on the quay, looking out over the water, still weary, still robbed of the ability to get the rest she needed. The bay had its usual morning calm, the glassy surface punctuated by the circular ripples of bluefish chasing after insects. Conditions like this seemed so fitting to the start of a day, a gentle westerly breeze in his face, and the odd silence that allowed one to hear the rumble of a boat's motor from so far away that the boat could not be seen. It was the sort of time that allowed you to be alone with nature. But he knew that Pam merely felt alone. Kelly walked out to her as quietly as he could and touched her waist with both his hands. "Good morning." She didn't answer for a long time, and Kelly stood still, holding her lightly, just enough that she could feel his touch. She was wearing one of his shirts, and he didn't want his touch to be sexual, only protective. He was afraid to press himself on a woman who'd suffered that kind of abuse, and could not predict where the invisible line might be. "So now you know," she said, just loudly enough to be heard over the silence, unable to turn and face him. "Yes," Kelly answered, equally quiet. "What do you think?" Her voice was a painful whisper. "I'm not sure what you mean, Pam." Kelly felt the trembling start, and he had to resist the urge to hold her tighter. "About me."
"About you?"
He allowed himself to get a little closer, altering his hold until his arms wrapped around her waist, but not tightly.
"I think you're beautiful. I think I'm real glad we met."
"I do drugs."
"The docs say you're trying to quit. That's good enough for me."
"It's worse than that. I've done things..."
Kelly cut her off. "I don't care about that, Pam. I've done things, too. And one thing you did for me was very nice. You gave me something to care about, and I didn't ever expect that to happen."
Kelly pulled her tighter.
"The things you did before we met don't matter. You're not alone, Pam. I'm here to help you if you want me to.
When you find out, she warned, I'll take my chances. I think I know the important parts already. I love you, Pam.
Kelly surprised himself with those words. He'd been too afraid to voice the thought even to himself. It was too irrational, but again emotion won out over reason, and reason, for once, found itself approving.
How can you say that? Pam asked.
Kelly gently turned her around and smiled.
Damned if I know. Maybe it's your tangled hair, or your runny nose.
He touched her chest through the shirt. No, I think it's your heart. No matter what's behind you, your heart is just fine.
You mean that, don't you? She asked, looking at his chest.
There was a long moment, then Pam smiled up at him, and that too was like a dawn. The orange-yellow glow of the rising sun lit up her face and highlighted her fair hair. Kelly wiped the tears from her face, and the wet feel of her cheeks eliminated whatever doubts he might have had.
We're going to have to get you some clothes. This is no way for a lady to dress.
Who says I'm a lady?
I do.
I'm so scared. Kelly pulled her against his chest. It's okay to be scared. I was scared all the time. The important part is to know that you're going to do it.
His hands rubbed up and down her back.
He hadn't intended to make this a sexual encounter, but he found himself becoming aroused until he realized that his hands were rubbing over scars made by men with whips or ropes or belts or other odious things. Then his eyes looked straight out over the water, and it was just as well that she couldn't see his face.
"You must be hungry," he said, stepping away from her, holding on to her hands.
She nodded.
"Starving.
That I can fix." Kelly led her by the hand back to the bunker. Already he loved her touch. They met Sam and Sarah coming from the other side of the island after a morning's walk and stretch.
"How are our two lovebirds?" Sarah asked with a beaming smile, because she'd already seen the answer, watching from 200 yards away.
"Hungry," Pam replied.
"And we're getting a couple of screws today," Kelly added with a wink.
"What?" Pam asked.
"Propellers," Kelly explained, "for Sam's boat."
"Screws?"
"Sailor talk. Trust me."
He grinned at her, and she wasn't sure if she could believe it or not.
"That took long enough," Tony observed, sipping coffee from a paper cup.
"Where's mine?" Eddie demanded, irritable from lack of sleep.
"You told me to put the fucking heater outside, remember? Get your own."
"You think I want all that smoke and shit in here? You can die from that monoxide shit," Eddie Morello said irritably.
Tony was tired as well. Too tired to argue with this loudmouth.
"Okay, man, well, the coffee pot's outside. Cups are there, too."
Eddie grumbled and went outside. Henry, the third man, was bagging the product and kept out of the argument. It had actually worked out a little better than he'd planned. They'd even bought his story about Angelo, thus eliminating one potential partner and problem. There was at least $300,000 worth of finished drugs now being weighed and sealed in plastic bags for sale to dealers. Things hadn't gone quite as planned. The expected few hours of work had lingered into an all-night marathon, as the three had discovered that what they paid for others to do wasn't quite as easy as it looked. The three bottles of bourbon they'd brought along hadn't helped either. Still and all, over $300,000 of profit from 16 hours of work wasn't all that bad. And this was just the beginning. Tucker was just giving them a taste. Eddie was still worried about the repercussions of Angelo's demise. But there was no turning back, not after the killing, and he'd been forced into backing Tony's play. He grimaced as he looked out of a vacant porthole towards an island north of what had once been a ship. Sunlight was reflecting off the windows of what was probably a nice, large power cruiser. Wouldn't it be nice to get one of those? Eddie Morello liked to fish, and maybe he could take his kids out sometime. It would be a good cover activity, wouldn't it? Or maybe crab, he told himself. After all, he knew what crabs ate. The thought evoked a quiet bark of a laugh, followed by a brief shudder. Was he safe, linked up with these men? He had just killed Angelo Verano, not 24 hours earlier. But Angelo wasn't part of the outfit, and Tony Piaggi was. He was their legitimacy, their pipeline to the street, and that made him safe, for a while. As long as Eddie stayed smart and alert. "What room do you suppose this was?" Tucker asked Piaggi, just to make conversation. "What do you mean?" "When this was a ship, looks like it was a cabin or something," he said, sealing the last envelope and placing it inside the beer cooler. "I never thought about that." Which was actually true. "Captain's cabin, you think?" Tony wondered. It was something to pass the time, and he was thoroughly sick of what they'd done all night. "Could be, I suppose. It's close to the bridge." The man stood, stretching, wondering why it was that he had to do all the hard work. The answer came easily enough. Tony was a made man. Eddie wanted to become one. He would never be, and neither would Angelo, Henry Tucker reflected, glad for it. He'd never trusted Angelo, and now he was no longer a problem. One thing about these people, they seemed to keep their word. And they would continue to, as long as he was their connection to the raw material, and not 1 minute longer. Tucker had no illusions about that. It had been good of Angelo to make his connection with Tony and Eddie, and Angelo's death had had exactly the effect on Henry that his own death would have on the other two. None. All men have their uses, Tucker told himself, closing the beer cooler. And the crabs had to eat, too. With luck, that would be the last killing for a while. Tucker didn't shrink from it, but he disliked complications that often came from killing. A good business ran smoothly, without fuss, and made money for everyone, which kept everyone happy, even the customers at the far end of the process. Certainly this load would keep them happy. It was good Asian heroin, scientifically processed and moderately cut with non-toxic elements that would give the users a rocket ship high and a calm, gentle descent back to whatever reality they were trying to escape. The sort of rush they would want to experience again, and so they'd return to their pushers, who could charge a little extra for this very good stuff. Asian Sweet was already the trade name. There was danger, having a street name. It gave the police something to target, a name to chase after, specific questions to ask. But that was the risk in having a hot product, and for that reason he'd selected his associates for their experience, connections, and security. His processing site had also been selected with an eye to security. They had a good 5 miles of visibility and a fast boat with which to make their escape. Yeah, there was danger, to be sure, but all life was danger, and you measured risk against reward. Henry Tucker's reward for less than a single day's work was $100,000 in untaxed cash, and he was willing to risk a lot for that. He was willing to risk far more for what Piaggi's connections could do, and now he had them interested. Soon they'd become as ambitious as he was. The boat from Solomon's arrived a few minutes early, with the propellers. The doctors hadn't told Kelly to keep Pam busy, but it was a simple enough prescription for her problems. Kelly wheeled the portable compressor back onto the dock and started it up, telling her how to regulate the airflow by keeping an eye on a gauge. Next, he got the wrenches he needed and set them on the dock also. One finger, this one. Two fingers, that one. And three fingers, this one here, okay? Right, Pam replied, impressed with Kelly's expertise. He was hamming things up a little, the rest of them knew, but that was okay with everyone. Kelly climbed down the ladder into the water, and his first job was to check the threads on the prop shafts, which appeared to be in decent shape. He reached his hand out of the water with one finger up and was rewarded with the right wrench, which he used to remove the retaining nuts, then handed them up one at a time. The whole operation took only 15 minutes, and the shiny new screws were fully attached, and new protective anodes set in place. He took his time giving the rudders a look, and decided that they'd be okay for the rest of the year, though Sam should keep an eye on them. It was a relief, as usual, to climb out of the water and breathe air that didn't taste like rubber.
"What do I owe you?" Rosen asked.
"For what?" Kelly took off his gear and switched off the compressor. "I always pay a man for his work," the surgeon said somewhat self-righteously. Kelly had to laugh. "Tell you what, if I ever need a back operation, you can make it a freebie. What is it you docs call this sort of thing?"
"A professional courtesy, but you're not a physician," Rosen objected. "And you're not a diver. You're not a seaman yet either, but we're going to fix that today, Sam."
"I was at the top of my power squadron class," Rosen boomed. "Doc, when we got kids from training school, we used to say, 'That's fine, sonny, but this here's the fleet. Let me get the gear stowed, and we'll see how well you can really drive this thing.'"
"I bet I'm a better fisherman than you are," Rosen proclaimed.
"Next, they're going to see who can pee the farthest," Sarah observed acidly to Pam. "That, too," Kelly laughed on his way back inside. 10 minutes later, he'd cleaned off and changed into a T-shirt and cutoffs. He took a place on the flying bridge and watched Rosen prepare his boat for getting underway. The surgeon actually impressed Kelly, particularly with his line handling. "Next time, let your blowers work for a while before you light off the engines," Kelly said after Rosen started up.
"But it's a diesel."
"Number one, it is a she, okay? Number two, it's a good habit to get into. The next boat you drive might be gas. Safety, Doc. You ever take a vacation and rent a boat?"
"Well, yes."
"In surgery, you do the same thing the same way every time?" Kelly asked. "Even when you don't really have to?" Rosen nodded thoughtfully.
"I hear you. Take her out."
Kelly waved. This Rosen did, and rather smartly, the surgeon thought. Kelly didn't. "Less rudder, more screws. You won't always have a breeze helping you away from alongside. Propellers push water, rudders just direct it a little. You can always depend on your engines, especially at low speed. And steering brakes sometimes. Learn how to do without it."
"Yes, Captain," Rosen growled.
It was like being an intern again, and Sam Rosen was used to having those people snap to his orders. 48, he thought, was a little old to be a student. "You're the captain. I'm just the pilot. These are my waters, Sam." Kelly turned to look down at the well deck. "Don't laugh, ladies. It'll be your turn next. Pay attention."
Quietly.
"You're being a good sport, Sam." 15 minutes later, they were drifting lazily on the tide, fishing lines out under a warm holiday sun. Kelly had little interest in fishing, and instead assigned himself lookout duty on the flying bridge while Sam taught Pam how to bait her line. Her enthusiasm surprised all of them. Sarah made sure that she was liberally covered with copper tone to protect her pale skin, and Kelly wondered if a little tan would highlight her scars. Alone with his thoughts on the flying bridge, Kelly asked himself what sort of man would abuse a woman. He stared out through squinted eyes at a gently rolling surface dotted with boats. How many people like that were within his sight? Why was it that you couldn't tell from looking at them? Packing the boat was simple enough. They'd stocked in a good supply of chemicals, which they would have to replenish periodically, but Eddie and Tony had access through a chemical supply business whose owner had casual ties to their organization. "I want to see," Tony said as they cast off. It wasn't as easy as he'd imagined, snaking their 18-footer through the tidal swamps, but Eddie remembered the spot well enough, and the water was still clear.
"Sweet Jesus," Tony gasped.
"Gonna be a good year for crabs," Eddie noted, glad that Tony was shocked. A fitting kind of revenge, Eddie thought, but it was not a pleasant sight for any of them. Half a bushel's worth of crabs were already on the body. The face was fully covered, as was one arm, and they could see more of the creatures coming in, drawn by the smell of decay that drifted through the water as efficiently as through the air. Nature's own form of advertising. On land, Eddie knew, it would be buzzards and crows.
"What do you figure? 2 weeks, maybe three, and then no more Angelo."
"What if somebody—"
"Not much chance of that," Tucker said, not bothering to look.
"Too shallow for a sailboat to risk coming in, and motorboats don't bother much.
There's a nice wide channel half a mile south. Fishing's better there, they say. I guess the crabbers don't like it here either. Piaggi had trouble looking away, though his stomach had already turned over once. The Chesapeake Bay blue crabs, with their claws, were dismantling the body already softened by warm water and bacteria. One little pinch at a time, tearing with their claws, picking up the pieces with smaller pincers, feeding them into their strangely alien mouths. He'd wondered if there would still be a face there, eyes to stare up at a world left behind. But crabs covered it, and somehow it seemed likely that the eyes had been the first things to go. The frightening part, of course, was that if one man could die this way, so could another. And even though Angelo had already been dead, somehow Piaggi was sure that being disposed of this way was worse than mere death. He would have regretted Angelo's death, except that it was business, and Angelo had deserved it. It was a shame, in a way, that this gruesome fate had to be kept a secret. But that was business, too. That was how you kept the cops from finding out. Hard to prove murder without a body. And here they had accidentally found a way to conceal a number of murders. The only problem was getting the bodies here, and not letting others know of the method of disposal. Because people talk, Tony Piaggi told himself, as Angelo had talked. A good thing that Henry had found out about that. "How about crab cakes when we get back to town?" Eddie Morello asked with a laugh, just to see if he could make Tony puke. "Let's get the fuck out of here," Tony replied quietly, settling into his seat. Tucker took the engine out of idle and picked his way out of the tidal marsh, back into the bay. Piaggi took a minute or two to get the sight out of his mind, hoping that he could forget the horror of it and remember only the efficiency of their disposal method. After all, they might be using it again. Maybe after a few hours he'd see humor in it, Tony thought, looking at the cooler. Under the 15 or so cans of National Bohemian was a layer of ice, under which were 20 sealed bags of heroin. In the unlikely event that anyone stopped them, it was unlikely that they'd look farther than the beer, the real fuel for bay boaters. Tucker drove the boat north, and the others laid out their fishing rods as though they were trying to find a good place to harvest a few rockfish from the Chesapeake. "Fishing in reverse," Morello said after a moment. Then he laughed loudly enough that Piaggi joined in. "Toss me a beer," Tony commanded between laughs. He was a made man, after all, and deserved respect. "Idiots," Kelly said quietly to himself. That 18-footer was going too fast, too close to other fishing boats. It could catch a few lines, and certainly would throw a wake sure to disturb other craft. That was bad sea manners, something Kelly was always careful to observe. It was just too easy to... Hell, it wasn't even hard enough to be easy. All you had to do was buy a boat, and you had the right to sail her around. No tests, no nothing. Kelly found Rosen's 7x50 binoculars and focused them on the boat that was coming close aboard. Three assholes, one of them holding up a can of beer in mock salute. "Bear off, dickhead," he whispered to himself. The jerks in a boat, drinking beer, probably half-potted already. Not even 11 o'clock yet. He gave them a good look and was vaguely grateful that they passed no closer than 50 yards. He caught the name. Henry's 8th. If he saw that name again, Kelly told himself, he'd remember to keep clear. "I got one," Sarah called. "Heads up, we got a big wake coming in from starboard." It arrived a minute later, causing the big Hatteras to rock 20 degrees left and right of vertical. "That," Kelly said, looking down at the other three, "is what I mean by bad sea manners." "Aye, aye," Sam called back. "I've still got 'em," Sarah said. She worked the fish in, Kelly saw, with consummate skill. "Pretty big, too." Sam got the net and leaned over the side. A moment later, he stood back up. The net contained a struggling rockfish, maybe 12 or 14 pounds. He dumped the net in a water-filled box in which fish could wait to die. It seemed cruel to Kelly, but it was only a fish, and he'd seen worse things than that. Pam started squealing a moment later as her line went taut. Sarah put her rod in its holder and started coaching her. Kelly watched,
The friendship between Pam and Sarah was as remarkable as that between himself and the girl. Perhaps Sarah was taking the place of the mother who had been lacking in affection, or whatever Pam's mother had lacked. Regardless, Pam was responding well to the advice and counsel of her new friend. Kelly watched with a smile that Sam caught and returned. Pam was new at this, tripping twice as she walked the fish around. Again Sam did the honors with the net, this time recovering an 8-pound blue. "Toss it back," Kelly advised. "They don't taste worth a damn." Sarah looked up. "Throw back her first fish. What are you, a Nazi? You have any lemon at your place, John?" "Yeah, why?" "I'll show you what you can do with a bluefish, that's why." She whispered something to Pam that evoked a laugh. The blue went into the same tank, and Kelly wondered how it and the rock would get along. Memorial Day, Dutch Maxwell thought, alighting from his official car at Arlington National Cemetery. Too many just a time for a 500-mile auto race in Indianapolis, or a day off, or the traditional start of the summer beach season, as testified to by the relative lack of auto traffic in Washington. But not to him, and not to his fellows. This was their day, a time to remember fallen comrades, while others attended to other things both more and less personal. Admiral Podolsky got out with him, and the two walked slowly and out of step, as admirals do. Casimir's son, Lieutenant Junior Grade Stanislas Podolsky, was not here, and probably never would be. His A-4 had been blotted from the sky by a surface-to-air missile, the reports had told them, nearly a direct hit. The young pilot had been too distracted to notice until perhaps the last second, when his voice had spoken its last epithet of disgust over the guard channel. Perhaps one of the bombs he'd been carrying had gone off sympathetically. In any case, the small attack bomber had dissolved into a greasy cloud of black and yellow, leaving little behind. And besides, the enemy wasn't all that fastidious about respecting the remains of fallen aviators. And so the son of a brave man had been denied his resting place with comrades. It wasn't something that Kaz spoke about. Podolsky kept such feelings inside. Rear Admiral James Greer was at his place, as he'd been for the previous 2 years, about 50 yards from the paved driveway, setting flowers next to the flag at the headstone of his son. "James," Maxwell said. The younger man turned and saluted, wanting to smile in gratitude for their friendship on a day like this, but not quite doing so. All three wore their navy blue uniforms because they carried with them a proper sort of solemnity. Their gold-braided sleeves glistened in the sun. Without a spoken word, all three men lined up to face the headstone of Robert White Greer, 1st Lieutenant, United States Marine Corps. They saluted smartly, each remembering a young man whom they had bounced on their knees, who had ridden his bike at Naval Station Norfolk and Naval Air Station Jacksonville with Kaz's son and Dutch's, who had grown strong and proud, meeting his father's ships when they'd returned to port, and talked only about following in his father's footsteps, but not too closely, and whose luck had proven insufficient to the moment, 50 miles southwest of Da Nang. It was the curse of their profession, each knew but never said, that their sons were drawn to it also, partly from reverence for what their fathers were, partly from a love of country imparted by each to each, most of all from a love of their fellow men. As each of the men standing there had taken his chances, so had Bobby Greer and Stas Podolsky taken theirs. It was just that luck had not smiled on two of the three sons. Greer and Podolsky told themselves at this moment that it had mattered, that freedom had a price, that some men must pay that price, else there would be no flag, no constitution, no holiday whose meaning people had the right to ignore. But in both cases, those unspoken words rang hollow. Greer's marriage had ended, largely from the grief of Bobby's death. Podolsky's wife would never be the same. Though each man had other children, the void created by the loss of one was like a chasm never to be bridged, and as much as each might tell himself that
Yes, it was worth the price. No man who could rationalize the death of a child could truly be called a man at all. And their real feelings were reinforced by the same humanity that compelled them to a life of sacrifice. This was all the more true because each had feelings about the war that the more polite called doubts, and which they called something else, but only among themselves. Remember the time Bobby went into the pool to get Mike Goodwin's little girl? Saved her life? Podolsky asked. I just got a note from Mike. Little Amy had twins last week, two little girls. She married an engineer down in Houston, works for NASA. I didn't even know she was married. How old is she now? James asked. Oh, she must be 20, 25. Remember her freckles, how the sun used to breed them down at Jack's? Little Amy, Greer said quietly. How they grow. Maybe she wouldn't have drowned that hot July day, but it was one more thing to remember about his son. One life saved, maybe three. That was something, wasn't it? Greer asked himself. The three men turned and left the grave without a word, heading slowly back to the driveway. They had to stop there. A funeral procession was coming up the hill. Soldiers of the 3rd Infantry Regiment, the Old Guard, doing their somber duty, laying another man to rest. The admirals lined up again, saluting the flag draped on the casket and the man within. The young lieutenant commanding the detail did the same. He saw that one of the flag officers wore the pale blue ribbon denoting the Medal of Honor, and the severity of his gesture conveyed the depth of his respect. "Well, there goes another one," Greer said with quiet bitterness after they had passed by. "Dear God, what are we burying these kids for? Pay any price, bear any burden, meet any hardship, support any friend, oppose any foe," Kaz quoted. "Wasn't all that long ago, was it? But when it came time to put the chips on the table, where were the bastards?" "We are the chips, Kaz," Dutch Maxwell replied. "This is the table." Normal men might have wept, but these were not normal men. Each surveyed the land dotted with white stones. This had been the front lawn of Robert E. Lee once. The house was still atop the hill, and the placement of the cemetery had been the cruel gesture of a government that had felt itself betrayed by the officer. And yet Lee had in the end given his ancestral home to the service of those men whom he had most loved. That was the kindest irony of this day, Maxwell reflected. "How do things look up the river, James?" "Could be better, Dutch. I have orders to clean house. I need a pretty big broom." "Have you been briefed in on Boxwood Green?" "No." Greer turned and cracked his first smile of the day. It wasn't much, but it was something, the others told themselves. "Do I want to be?" "We'll probably need your help." "Under the table?" "You know what happened with Kingpin," Casimir Podolsky noted. "They were damned lucky to get out," Greer agreed. "Keeping this one tight, eh?" "You bet we are." "Let me know what you need. You'll get everything I can find. You doing the three work, Kaz?" "That's right." Any designator with a three at the end denoted the operations and planning department, and Podolsky had a gift for that. His eyes glittered as brightly as his wings of gold in the morning sun. "Good," Greer observed. "How's little Dutch doing?" "Flying for Delta now. Co-pilot, you'll make captain in due course, and I'll be a grandfather in another month or so." "Really? Congratulations, my friend." "I don't blame him for getting out. I used to, but not now." "What's the name of the SEAL who went in to get him?" "Kelly. He's out, too," Maxwell said. "You should have gotten the medal for him, Dutch," Podolsky said. "I read the citation. That was as hairy as they come." "I made him a chief. I couldn't get the medal for him." Maxwell shook his head. "Not for rescuing the son of an admiral, Kaz. You know the politics." "Yeah." Podolsky looked up the hill. The funeral procession had stopped, and the casket was being moved off the gun carriage. A young widow was watching her husband's time on Earth end. "Yeah, I know about politics. Tucker eased the boat into the slip. The inboard-outboard drive made that easy. He cut the engine and grabbed the mooring lines, which he tied off quickly. Tony and Eddie lifted the beer cooler out while Tucker collected the loose gear and snapped a few covers into place before joining his companions on the parking lot.
"Well, that was pretty easy," Tony noted.
The cooler was already in back of his Ford Country Squire station wagon.
"Who do you suppose won the race today?" Eddie asked.
They'd neglected to take a radio with them for the trip.
"I had a yard bet on Foyt just to make it interesting."
"Not Andretti?" Tucker asked.
"He's a paisan, but he ain't lucky. Betting is business," Piaggi pointed out. Angelo was a thing of the past now, and the manner of his disposal was, after all, a little amusing, though the man might never eat crab cakes again.
"Well," Tucker said, "you know where to find me."
"You'll get your money," Eddie said, speaking out of place. "End of the week, the usual place." He paused.
"What if demand goes up?"
"I can handle it," Tucker assured him. "I can get all you want."
"What the hell kind of pipeline do you have?" Eddie asked, pushing further.
Angelo wanted to know that too, remember?
"Gentlemen, if I told you that, you wouldn't need me, would you?"
Tony Piaggi smiled.
"Don't trust us?"
"Sure," Tucker smiled. "I trust you to sell the stuff and share the money with me."
Piaggi nodded approval.
"I like smart partners. Stay that way. It's good for all of us. You have a banker?"
"Not yet. Haven't thought about it much," Tucker lied.
"Start thinking, Henry. We can help set you up, overseas bank. It's secure, numbered account, all that stuff. You can have somebody you know check it out. Remember, they can track money if you're not careful. Don't live it up too much. We've lost a lot of friends that way."
"I don't take chances, Tony."
Piaggi nodded.
"Good way to think. You have to be careful in this business. The cops are getting smart."
"Not smart enough."
Neither were his partners when it came to that, but one thing at a time. Chapter 5. Commitments. The package arrived with a very jet-lagged captain at the Navy's intelligence headquarters in Suitland, Maryland. On-staff photo interpretation experts were supplemented by specialists from the Air Force's 1127th Field Activities Group at Fort Belvoir. It took 20 hours to go through the entire process, but the frames from the Buffalo Hunter were unusually good, and the American on the ground had done what he was supposed to do, look up and stare at the passing reconnaissance drone.
"Poor bastard paid the price for it," a Navy chief observed to his Air Force counterpart.
Just behind him, the photo caught an NVA soldier with his rifle up and reversed.
"I'd like to meet you in a dark alley, you little fuck."
"What do you think?" The Air Force Senior Master Sergeant slid an ID photo over.
"Close enough, I'd bet money on it."
Both intelligence specialists thought it odd that they had such a thin collection of files to compare with these photographs, but whoever had guessed well. They had a match. They didn't know that what they had was a series of photographs of a dead man. Kelly let her sleep, glad that she was able to without any chemical help. He got himself dressed, went outside, and ran around his island twice. The circumference was about 3/4 of a mile, to work up a sweat in the still morning air. Sam and Sarah, early risers also, bumped into him while he was cooling down on the dock. "The change in you is remarkable, too," she observed. She paused for a moment. "How was Pam last night?" The question jarred Kelly into a brief silence, followed by, "What?"
"Oh, shit, Sarah."
Sam looked away and nearly laughed. His wife flushed almost as crimson as the dawn. "She persuaded me not to medicate her last night," Sarah explained. "She was a little nervous, but she wanted to try, and I let her talk me out of it. That's what I meant, John. Sorry." How to explain last night? First, he'd been afraid to touch her, afraid to seem to be pressing himself on her. And then she'd taken that as a sign that he didn't like her anymore. And then things had worked out. "Mainly, she has some damned fool idea." Kelly stopped himself. Pam could talk to her about this, but it wasn't proper for him to do so.